And as always, the views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the host, and not necessarily those of the staff or management of KOWS Community Radio.
Someone, but I don't know who. Now I'm standing alone, and I'm trying to remember. Sometimes I wonder how I ever started loving you. A new time of wind, can you blow for me one more time and take me on back to the star? The midnight moon shines so bright, nearly pulled us up to heaven by the strings of our heart. Take me back, Josephine, to that cold and dark December. I'm missing someone, but I don't know who. Now I'm standing alone, I'm trying to remember. Sometimes I wonder how I ever started loving you. And moon and sun shine on me, come light inside my window and rest on my brow. While asleep, carry me back home if my dreams would allow. Take me back, Josephine, to that cold and dark December. I'm missing someone, but I don't know. Now I'm standing alone, and I'm trying to remember. Sometimes I wonder how I ever started loving you. Take me back, Josephine, to that cold and dark December. Help me understand why I'm still loving you.
On this Friday, it looks like we're on the verge of getting some much-awaited warmth. It looks like we're beginning to enter into summer, which would be welcome. As well, the war goes on. Our great leader today announced that he was once again going to bomb Persia into oblivion. For what reasons, I don't quite know. We can only hope that soon this will come to an end and we can go on with our lives. But for as long as this is continuing, I have a special add-on for the mountain, and that is I am telling the 1001 Arabian Nights, or some selected stories from that wonderful, wonderful, wonderful collection that came out of Persia in the Middle East. When we last left off a couple weeks ago, we had three old men sitting, or actually four old men sitting by the side of a tree in the desert awaiting for the arrival of a genie who was going to take the life of one of the men, a merchant who had inadvertently taken the life of the genie's son. And one of the old men had approached the great jinn and had made an entreaty. He'd asked him if he could tell him an extraordinary story. Would the genie spare or at least grant a third of the blood of the merchant to the old man? And the genie had agreed to this. And so the old man, who had arrived on the scene with a young deer being led by the chain, told his story. He said, "Genie, please understand that this deer that I have on a chain is in fact not a deer, but she is my cousin. She is my own flesh and blood." And he explained that she was promised to him when she was very young, when she was barely 12, and that she in fact came of age under his roof. And that for 30 long years they lived together, but in all that time she failed to bear him children, and for 30 years he treated her with great kindness. But at last he took for himself a lover, and very quickly his lover bore a son for him. And very soon after that, the wife grew jealous of both the lover and the son. Until one day the man had to go abroad, and he left the son and lover in the care of his wife, and he disappeared for an entire year. But during that time, the wife, she managed to learn magic and train herself in the ways of sorcery, and she cast a spell on the old man's son and turned him into a calf. And then she cast another spell, and she changed the mother into a cow, and she took both the calf and this cow, and she gave them to a shepherd. When the old man returned and saw his lover and his son missing, he inquired, and his wife, his cousin, said, "Oh, your lover, she died, and your son, he ran away. I have no idea. How can I possibly know to where he has gone?" And the old man, he wept in grief. And when the time came, when the season came for Eid al-Adha, for the great sacrifice in honor of Ibrahim, he called to the shepherd and he said, "Bring me a fat cow for the sacrifice." And he brought the cow that was in fact his lover. And as the old man rolled up his sleeves and he held the knife the very neck of the cow, she moaned lowly. She cried, "My son, my son." And tears ran down the cow's cheeks. And the old man was amazed. He was full of pity. He turned away and he asked the shepherd for another cow. But his wife, his cousin, stepped in and said, "No, no, you must kill her. That cow is fat and will be good for the feast." And so the old man approached the cow, and again, just as he placed the knife on her throat, she cried out, "My son, my son." And the old man could go no further. So he gave the cow to the butcher, or to be butchered by the shepherd. And of course, when the shepherd skinned her, he found neither meat nor fat around the bones. There was nothing at all to eat. And so he took the remnants of the cow away. And then he brought the calf, the old man's son, his very blood, his very flesh that had been transformed into a calf. And when the calf saw the old man, he broke loose from the rope. He ran to him. He threw himself at the old man's feet. He rubbed his face against him. And the old man suddenly felt possessed by mercy. His body, his heart went soft with pity. He thought of blood and of sacred ties and of what it meant to sacrifice and of the injustice of taking the life of the innocent. And he thought of these things, and he wept, and he raked his hands across the earth, and at last he turned away, and he said to the shepherd, "Put him back among the flock. Be kind to him. Find kindness, and bring me another, But then the old man's wife shouted, "No, kill him, butcher him." And the old man turned, and angrily he said, "It was on your advice that I killed the cow, for nothing at all. And now I will spare this calf." And his wife, his cousin, grew even more angry, and she looked at him and she said, "You must kill it." And so he took the knife and he bound the calf. And it was at that moment that the morning gained on Scheherazade, and she cut her speaking short. "What a strange story," her sister said. And she said, as she had done on the nights before, "If you allow me to live for one more night, I can tell you far stranger." And so King Shahryar decided that he would spare Scheherazade for one more night. And when night fell again, Scheherazade's sister Dunyazad said, "If you're not asleep, tell us a story to break the waking night." And Scheherazade agreed. On what or on whom did the tetramorph gaze? On the back wall, John portrayed the greatest hits of Jesus Christ. A man is born, he's baptized, and within him is released the Holy Spirit. Then boom, it's the night before the crucifixion, and he's alone in a garden. A man on a cross, a body cradled in the arms of a woman. And then the dispatching of the apostles. In the center of the back wall, the figure of a transfiguring Christ, his head bent back and craning upward as he is extracted from the mortal world and into heaven. But lots of things are missing. There are no parables or mustard seeds or eyes of needles or sermons on the mount or bequeathing of the Lord's Prayer or taking of communion. There are no miracles, no walking on water, no raising of the dead, no curing of the blind, no water into wine, not even a resurrection. John's telling of the story instead focuses just on the factual and humane. A man was born, he was anointed, he felt sorrow, he died, he was mourned, and then his story was told. John would spend another year constructing the rear wall. He layers on narrow strips of parchment paper and brushes them with glue. Piece by piece, he begins in the morning. 12 hours later, he is still at it, and dusk has set. In the panels, he cuts holes, portals to hold the prints that he would make depicting the life of Christ. From afar, the pictures appear to be positioned almost by happenstance. The dimensions are all over the map, the locations of the prints asymmetrical. The Epiphany and the Baptism are jammed together in the corner, the Agony in the garden set aside at a distance. Random shadows of patterns and other images emerge on the panels. A Swiss cross, a kite swallow alit in the air, an emptied pattern box awaiting to be filled. The images themselves are not so much prints as vitrines, a cabinet of curiosities or apertures into a magic box in which we might glimpse a mechanical apparatus just beyond our understanding. What stories do we choose to tell, and to what end? This is your host, Andrew Lewis, and you are listening to The Mountain, an Adoration in a Multitude of Parts. I realize something else at this late date. It's actually less a realization than a question. And it comes back to that question asked by a student so many decades ago. Who is I? Who's telling these stories to you? And also, does it matter? Some would say not, while others might say yes. Perhaps that's why Huck Finn began his tale by declaring that you don't know nothing about him unless you first read a book by Tom Sawyer. And why the 1001 Nights launched first with the stories of the betrayal of Sultan Shahryar and of Shahrazad, the storyteller herself. And why Towns once sang, "One time, friends, I had a ma and even had a pa. He beat her with a belt once 'cause she cried." As if that dissipated explanation was needed before you could understand anything at all. My own father had been born in New Jersey and had gone to Temple University, and then the University of Pennsylvania, and then Princeton, and he failed out of there. His advisors questioned whether he really had the chops to be a historian. But it was in the 1950s, and so perhaps he was chased out simply because he was a Jew. He fled out west to the University of Montana, and then to Long Beach State, and then the University of Southern California. Later, people would say that he held degrees from 6 universities, which was only partly true. He would eventually teach American history at a community college and write books about journalism in the gold fields, and he worked to keep kids in school so that they could keep their 2S deferments during the Vietnam War. He died of a brain tumor in 1971. He was 43. In his living form, he had been a bookish man. My mother was born in Latvia and lost her own mother in 1943 in the middle of the war, and she and her twin brother fled under bombardment in 1944. They came to the United States when she was 21. By the age of 25, she had a more commanding grasp of the English language than most native speakers ever would. She would later run away from home in Cleveland to Denver, where she would meet my father. They would move to California, then he would die, and then she would give up. And then she was in a nursing home following a lobotomy. She was 53. I'd come home to San Diego in the last year of her life because she had told me in her own simple, fractured way that she had wanted to go back to the country from which she had come. The Berlin Wall had just come down, and so, against all odds, it seemed possible. I was 24 years old, and that trip would be the most difficult thing I would ever do. In the end, it would kill her. My girlfriend and I had just moved into A Street. That is where we lived during the preparations for the trip and for the long aftermath. After her death, I was possessed by an anguish so profound that it would not diminish for years. I had no plans at that time, only that I wanted to tell her story. So there, that's the short of it. I once had a ma, and I even had a pa.
There's a voice that pulls me stumbling through a symphony, and the less of it I need, the more I get, till I'm swept up by the shape of all the centuries, like an echo in the chambers of my chest. I think she fears I'll be a servant to my history, or worse, a slave to someone else's misplaced doubts. So I try too hard to kill what's out to kill me, till I'm blind and hiding in the lion's mouth. And the words she aches to hear pour through my canyon, and they're singing in the caverns of my limbs. No, I do my best to try to understand them. They only follow me like vultures in the end. I once read that I should write something worth reading, or I should do something worth writing about. And as my ears, they buzz like bees upon the ceiling, I start to pour a little more than I'm allowed. I said our hearts know deeper seasons than our memories. She said this harvest might sustain us for a year. Of all the thousand ways the world could tempt me, I never met a better fighter than her fear. So as I try to breathe the air that she is breathing, and we dance a lightless dance upon my floor, I am burning to tell her she's all I'm needing. I'm drowned out by all the noise outside the door. Well, carried by the current of the morning, miles below the surface of the dawn, this is not the place that I was born in, but that doesn't mean it's not the place where I belong.
Kindergarten, Mrs. Cook, Christmas time. My dad is dying, but I do not know this yet. He and my mother have come to the autumn open house. It's dark out, and I have never been at the school when it is dark, and it feels mysterious and magical. This is my school. This is my house, and we are hosting families here. The children run about in the darkness. We play and are excited to play, and we play tag because this is what we know to do. My father is distant, and he acts strange. Strange as if he has receded, and he is both a child and terribly old. He and my mother have been fighting. He says the word headache. He says it again and again.
Miss Cook at Christmas time. She has us all sit on the green carpet, and she has a story to tell. She tells how it was winter, and the shepherds were watching over the lambs, and it was night, and it was cold, and then an angel appeared before them and told them that a special child would soon be born. I've never heard this story. No one has ever told it. And I don't know why Miss Cook is telling it to us now, but from her mouth it sounds more magical, more prescient than anything I have ever heard. The next day, she tells us how there was a young woman. She was going to have a baby, and she was traveling through the desert with her husband. And she rode on the back of a donkey, and they had to travel to a distant town so that they could be counted. And this woman also knew something special, that the baby did not have a father. Kindergarten class lets out, and my mother is there waiting for me. We walk up the stairs from the playground. Miss Cook is telling us a story, I tell her, and I recount the details, and I'm so excited to know what will happen next. But my mother already seems to know the story, even knowing how it will end. On the next day, Miss Cook tells us how they came to the town and there was no place to stay, how they were turned away from inn after inn, that all the inns were full because so many people had come to be counted. There was no place to stay, but an innkeeper, he took pity on them and allowed them to sleep in the stable. And on that night, the woman gave birth to a child, and the animals had gathered all around. And then, on the last day, Miss Cook told of how wise men had followed a star, following far across the desert until they arrived at a barn and a manger, and there was a child upon whom they bestowed gifts and whom they adored. It was Friday, the last day before Christmas recess. Miss Cook ended the story there and wished us a Merry Christmas. But surely that couldn't be it. A magical baby had just been born. He'd been recognized by kings and magicians. If this was the Son of God, wouldn't word have spread? Wouldn't the multitudes have come to adore him? Wouldn't the world in that very instant be transfigured? Surely something must have happened. But instead, nothing happened. Instead, the father and mother just went on their way and disappeared into the desert. In my heart, I felt that this story that had begun so wonderfully, in the end, was just a big dud. We, of course, now know that there were many more things that happened, many more things that Miss Cook failed to tell us. These stories would come to us in different ways. On the night the baby was born, all the animals in the barn gained language and were able to speak. This was basically fact. There was also a king, and his name was Wenceslas, and someone got some turtle doves and a partridge in a pear tree, and three kings of Orient are, whatever that is, they came to worship the child, and they brought presents. And there was a poor little drummer boy who had no gift to give, so instead he played a song. I believe it went rump-a-pum-pum, and that gift was more valued than any other, and it made the baby happy. And then later, there was a reindeer who had a red nose, and all the other reindeer, they made fun of him, and then he ran away from home to the island of misfit toys. And then there was an elf who wanted to be a dentist, and they caught the abominable snowman and took him to a man named Santa, and then the reindeer with the red nose pulled a sleigh that night. And then there was also an old miserly man who was visited by all these ghosts, and then he became a generous man and gave a big roast turkey to a crippled kid named Tiny Tim. Miracles happened, one in particular on 34th Street. And there was a snowman who came to life, and he could talk. And he wasn't that bright, but Then he went in a greenhouse and he melted, and all the children were sad. But then he wore a magic hat and he came to life again one day. And also, there was a kid who had no friends and was really bad at baseball, and he was supposed to get a Christmas tree, except that it was really crappy and it had made him feel terrible until all the other kids rallied and helped him see that it was the best Christmas tree of all. Much later, I would learn about an elf, I think, who grew up to be a man and moved to New York City, and also a train that I think Tom Hanks drove, and it went all the way to the North Pole. John didn't have it in his mind to tell any of these stories. For one long week, he drove up to Northern California, where his sister lived with her husband and family. He took pictures of everyone in his sister's backyard. He had them stand beneath a blazing sun in different positions, draped in robes. He returned, and from these prints, he made multiple sketches, playing with different arrangements. The figure of the Magi would eventually be based on the form of John's nephew, his sister's husband, and Jim, Trina Dixon's husband. The back wall and the prints and paintings that would depict the narrative of Christ would themselves take nearly a year. John wanted the prints to be recessed into the walls, and so he cut apertures into the panels and framed in boxes that would contain them. John had been looking at Renaissance drawings and paintings and had studied how Giotto would do a drawing into wet plaster. In Sinopia painting, lines are set on an underlayer of plaster. A drawing would first be made on paper and then the holes pricked in the lines. Then the paper would be laid over the wet plaster and tapped with soot or pigment, and like that, the outline of the forms would be transferred onto the moist surface. Each day a new layer of plaster would be laid down into that day's section, and Giotto would paint into that plaster while it was still wet. John wanted that feeling of wetness and embeddedness in his prints, so he developed his own method of applying Sinopia techniques to paper. After college, John had studied printmaking in England. There he had wanted to do prints on the parchment of an old atlas. But it was oil-based printing, the colors and lines too sharp and full. So he'd paint wash on the atlas to make the colors more faint, and then print onto the wash. As well, working with copper plates was painstaking and expensive. John was broke and needed to find new tools to render different effects. His method of printmaking evolved there. On the paper for the Epiphany, John applied two base colors. For the print, he drew the image on a map board, quickly penciling in the figures of the Magi and Mary, her back turned, looking down at the creche. The bull and the donkey look on from the background. John's dog, Sadie, ambling forward in the foreground. Then he went over the lines with an etching pen, scoring with a metal point the lines that he had drawn. He erased his drawing and then carefully coated the map board with an acrylic gel and let it dry. For each print, just the making of the map board would take a week or 2 weeks. In this epiphany, there would be no barn, no Bethlehem, just an abstracted geometrical space. John bisected the plane horizontally and then vertically, the right side becoming a portal or aperture. A Street. That first Christmas, I bought my girlfriend a bike at the Adams Avenue bike shop. I hid it in the garage and I asked our landlord for a favor. At around 8 a.m., I said, I wanted him to carry the bike up our stairs and place it on the roof by the chimney, and then to stomp heavily on the pitched roof so we would awaken. He smiled. I remember that smile. A heavy silver Orthodox cross hung about his neck. He would be delighted, he said. Anna found her new bike on the roof by the chimney. We drank champagne and ate scones. Then later that morning, we crossed the yard to Mark's house, and he, in his own dying, embarrassed us with riches. A bottle of Swedish gin, a decanter. He talked to us about the furniture he would be refinishing. He gave us tips on how to find rare pieces and what to look for. We talked of Rietveld. We talked of Danish modern. And he gave us that brushed aluminum whipped cream dispenser, a gift more rare than any bestowed by the Magi. The mendicants pushed their shopping cart down A Street in the rain. He was older than us. She didn't look more than 17, and she held an infant in her arms. The three were like wet dogs. The two had flattened faces and spread eyes of fetal alcohol syndrome. She had a warm smile, but hardly spoke. He did all the talking, but much of what he said about to where they were going and from where they had come did not make much sense. But we could not let them be in the rain, and so we invited them up to our apartment so that they could bathe and get warm and clean. We got food in them, and some things for the baby. How had she met him? Why were they there? Where had they come from? There was a story for sure, but no matter how he said it, we couldn't make sense. They may have slept in our living room. They may have left their shopping cart of things in the garage. In the morning, we found him rustling in the garage. He was just getting his things, he said. He asked if we could call a friend, someone he said he had met at church. If we called him, this man would help them get on their feet. He had a plan, he said. We called, and later that morning, a Somalian man showed at our house. I can't remember now the transit. Somehow I ended up in his car, and we drove down the hill toward the warehouses in San Diego. The Somalian had helped him and housed him. He had been in this country for but a few years, part of a growing North African community. He worked hard. He was new to San Diego, new even to the English language, but he was a Christian, a Coptic Christian, a Christian who had descended from the preachings of St. Mark, and he had taken pity. He was kind, and he had a car. He was capable, and he felt it his duty as a Christian to look after his fellow man. The next day we found our landlord Keith in the driveway, and he was livid. Those people who stayed in the garage, he said, they stole my tools and other things as well. We offered to buy new tools, which we could hardly afford. but Keith refused to let us. Each year we do these things. We recreate in our own ways that first moment of adoration. But who among us thinks of the quiet sacredness of that first moment and of the great cost? The following Christmas, Keith, the recovering alcoholic, made us a dark plum pudding soaked richly in rum. For all of us, our futures were unknown, life uncertain. Keith and Mark and the circle of friends and lovers that rippled out from them, among my girlfriend and I, they were all living on borrowed time. We didn't know, we will never know, where holiness lies. Of all of us, Mark and Keith, the mendicants, the field of lovers all now dead, we will never know in what form shall come redemption.
It's still a light is shining from that lamp on down the hall. Maybe the star of Bethlehem wasn't a star at all. In
the final print, we cannot see the Christ. The animals' expressions are opaque. Whatever there exists beyond our language, beyond whatever we are capable of holding within the smallness of our thoughts. The oxen gazes forward toward the viewer. The donkey that carried Mary from Nazareth to Bethlehem seems disinterested in the whole affair. The blue tick healer turns away from the scene. The woman and the three kings gaze down at the crash hidden behind the figure of the Virgin. The revelation of God feels strangely muted, as if the wise men and Mary are more perplexed than astonished. Later, when the Magi decline to return to Herod and reveal the identity of the Son of God, Herod is said to have ordered that all male babes in Bethlehem be executed. What would later be called the Massacre of the Innocents. The ass would bear Mary and her child on his back and carry them in exile to Egypt. But as for the others, those who had remained. The centurions would go from home to home, and they beheaded and skewered any male infant to be found on the tip of their swords. They bled them on the floors before their mothers and fathers. These infants were the first to pay the price of Christ's birth, unwilling Christian martyrs. The story of the innocents appears in the Gospel of Mark. Some consider it apocryphal, which leads one to ask, if the story is not true, how could God allow apocrypha, falsehoods, to enter into the Bible, the chronicle of his word, the sole surviving documentation of the birth of his son? How could our lies and stories be allowed to conflate with the absoluteness of his truth? And if the story is in fact true, then does that not damn God as well? To take innocence as the blood sacrifice to consecrate the birth of his son? And if the children were taken before they had sinned and were therefore guaranteed heavenly cribs, there was no guarantee for their parents. Or contrarily, what if they had been taken before they had the chance to take communion of the flesh and blood of their Savior and were damned to never be relieved of their original sin? But the donkey, the ass, he would have no thoughts of such matters. He would simply stare unknowing. He would gaze restrained as the one to hear Christ's message, but to not ever understand it. And to be fated, always to bear the Christ toward his birth, toward his exile, and eventually through the gates of Jerusalem toward his crucifixion.
Sick. I'm gonna make you love me.
You have been listening to The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts. Thank you for your presence and your attention. I'll do my best to give you the same. We opened with Josephine, a Brandi Carlile song covered by Anderson East on the Cover Stories album, followed by Coventry Carol by Sufjan Stevens, composed to commemorate the slaughter of the innocents, followed by Bees by the Ballroom Thieves, Hark the Angels Sing from the Charlie Brown Christmas Pageant. That's Vince Guaraldi, if you don't remember. Star of Bethlehem by Neil Young, and closing with the rousing I'm Going to Make You Love Me by Buddy and Judy Miller. We'll be walking out with an old standard, The Wait by the band. I encourage you to also check out the versions by Mavis Staples and Aretha Franklin. In this context, you get yourself a whole new listen. I hope you enjoy it. If you're enjoying these stories, I encourage you to subscribe to The Mountain on The Mountain Substack. Just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, and it should come up. If you want to listen to back episodes, you can go to the original podcast versions on Spotify. Again, just Google The Mountain, an adoration in a multitude of parts, or search in Spotify. And by all means, if you are enjoying the listen, and it makes your world a little bit bigger, I would be grateful and indebted if you would share with your friends. Please have a great day or a good night wherever you are, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Put the load right on me.